What's behind the spike in distracted driving crashes and fatalities? One major factor is thought to be texting while driving. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we'll look at the science behind distracted driving. Also, what's behind the increase in suicides in Iowa? How to fund legal services for low-income Iowans? An Iowa Police Department brings back baseball card-like cop cards. It's about more than just fun. And we'll look at how this winter is stacking up against winters in the past. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about the spike in distracted driving crashes and fatalities, the science behind what makes us distracted. You can guess, our cell phones, texting, talking on them, thought to be a major factor here. We'll talk about that and proposal to change laws here in Iowa that may restrict talking and texting in cars even further. Also, later in the hour, we'll look at how this winter is stacking up against winters past. Plenty to come. A handful of conversations on this News Buzz edition of River to River. We start off with this. 445 people completed suicide in Iowa in the year 2013. And that's a 17% increase from the previous year. And it's the most since at least 1989, according to the most recent data released last month by the Iowa Department of Public Health. State officials did not cite a reason for the increase. We're going to talk to Sam Cochran with those questions, director of the University Counseling Service at the University of Iowa, joining us by phone. Hello, Sam.
Ben, hi.
Hi. So what factors do you think are behind this 17% increase from 2012 to 2013?
Well, it's a great question. It's kind of hard to pin down a particular specific factor with these numbers because suicide rates have been just doggedly hard to understand over the years. But two things jumped out to me as I looked at the numbers. One was what I would call a possibly an age cohort effect, which we know that the suicide rates are highest in the population group 45 to 64. That's the baby boomers. The rate is higher there. And as that age group ages, you're going to see an increase in the rates in general. Mm-hmm. So within the state of Iowa, and I think maybe in general, we do have a bit of an older population in Iowa. As that bubble, the boomer bubble, kind of continues to grow in that increasing age range, rates are going to bump up a little bit.
Is there anything about that age range, 45 to 64? Is it simply that it's a larger group of people, the baby boomers making their way through the population?
Well, that's part of it. And then there's a lot of speculation about boomers being a little bit demanding and kind of, wanting to create their own lives and change the future and so on and so forth, kind of really taking charge of things. And at some point, as we age, we know that suicide rates increase with age. The tendency to want to take charge of one's life and possibly one's death may come into play there. We don't really know, to be honest with you. But that's one thing that kind of stuck out to me as a possible way to account for this bump in the 2013 rate. Mm-hmm. But there was another one that I noticed, and it kind of, when you look at Iowa compared with the U.S., and I'm going to kind of switch the focus just a little bit here, the highest rates are in states that are rural and probably have limited access to mental health care. Wyoming is the highest rate of almost 30 per 100,000. Alaska's got 23 per 100,000. The lowest rates are heavily urbanized states, and we're right about in the middle. But I can't help but wonder if maybe some of the more challenging aspects of access to mental health care in the state and kind of the difficulty accessing mental health beds in particular for people that need safe environments who might be suicidal might be beginning to come into play here in terms of showing up in some of this bump in rates.
Mm-hmm. Do you see Iowa there susceptible? Do we have a need there that's not being met, perhaps?
I would say yes, we do. Now, I'm looking at that from a bit of a biased perspective in terms of a mental health provider, but I have heard stories of patients who have gone to an emergency room because of a safety concern and have been held in the emergency room, not so much against their will, but they've been kept in the emergency room for a day or two or three because there's no bed available. And it's difficult to find a bed that's in the local community. We've here in Iowa City, we've had students who have been evaluated for hospitalization who've had to be transported to Waterloo or to Muscatine or to the Quad Cities. So yes, I think we do have a gap there in terms of a kind of higher level of care for people who may need a more protected environment. That's a challenge. And then I think it's even amplified with in a kind of rural setting.
Mm-hmm. Before we say goodbye, after having you comment on this bit of information about suicides in Iowa, remind us of the red flags for detecting someone who may be contemplating suicide.
Well, the big ones, often, you know, people will give some signals. They may say that they're thinking about it, or they may make a more oblique reference about, oh, you won't have to worry about me next week because things just will be real different. Giving away possessions, changes in typical kind of behavior patterns of someone who is normally outgoing and very gregarious becomes withdrawn or sullen or irritable. Just any kind of change in typical baseline behavior you notice, it doesn't necessarily mean the person is thinking about suicide right then, but what it may signify is that they're stressed, they're struggling, they may need someone to reach out and touch them and try and offer a way to help them get help.
Mm-hmm. When is that? So when you see some unusual behavior along the lines that you saw, when should you reach out outside of your home, of your family, to a professional? When should you seek advice or professional services?
Well, I think anytime there's a noticeable alteration in kind of baseline. So if someone who has normally been a good sleeper is having sleep disruption, someone who has normally had positive relations with families or friends is all of a sudden very irritable or angry. Someone who may be seeing an escalation in alcohol or other substance use. Obviously, someone who may be referencing a wish to die or a wish to commit suicide. We'd want to be sure that any of those signs are noticed and that a person who may notice them can know what to do to get the person to seek help.
Okay. Sam Cochran, thank you for joining us, Director of the University Counseling Services at the University of Iowa. We do want to give out at the end of this segment any information here at the Suicide Prevention and Crisis Hotline. This is a national hotline that feeds people into local services. Is that right, Sam?
Yes, it does.
1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255, the Suicide Prevention and Crisis Hotline. Sam, thanks again for joining us.
Ben, thank you for this important topic. Thanks very much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. An investigation of the tiny eastern Iowa city of Vining has identified more than $30,000 in improper spending over a six-year period. That's according to a report released this week. Now, it may not sound like much, but consider this, $30,000. Vining is a town of only 50 residents. Let's talk with the official who identified this improper spending. Mary Mosman is Iowa Auditor of State. Mary Mosman, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Good afternoon. In our Des Moines studio, what happened in the case of Vining, Iowa? What was the tip-off here?
The tip-off was unusual because in this particular case, the former city clerk turned herself in. She walked into the Tama County Sheriff's Office and told them that she had been taking city funds for personal use, and it was something that she stated that she did because of health reasons and loss of job for her husband, and she intended to pay the city back, but the situation simply spiraled out of control, and she needed to have it stopped, so she was turning herself in. Mm. And we got brought in then by the local officials, and We basically verified that, yes, she had been using city funds for personal reasons for a little over 6 years.
I have to believe that's an exception to have someone turn themselves in for embezzlement.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the impact as an auditor. What can you tell us about the impact of $32,243 to a town of 50 residents over 60 years? Six years.
Yes, it is significant. These are public funds. These are to be used for public purposes. And in this particular case, over $30,000 was not, this is not a city that has other sources of resources besides the state property tax, or I'm sorry, the county property taxes, the state local option sales tax, and then city residents pay various fees. And that all comprises their budget. And the clerk was the one person who had access to the city's checking accounts, and she used it for personal purposes. Mm-hmm. One thing that I would like to mention regarding this is that many of these, we have a lot of cities in Iowa that have very small populations, and all of these cities have somebody who's going to be in charge of their finances. They're also going to be city council members, mayors, other city officials that have a fiduciary responsibility surrounding the public assets, the resources, the funds. These cities, depending on their population, may or may not have audit requirements. So there's, prior to 2013, a city such as Vining had absolutely no audit requirements. In other words, nobody from the outside, no auditor from the outside, stepping in and verifying the financial transactions, making sure things are being handled appropriately.
So the town itself makes that determination? The state can't come and say, we will just audit everybody who's a town or a city?
No, that's what I wanted to make sure was mentioned here, because this is fairly new. Prior to 2013, cities that had a population of 700 or less had no audit requirements whatsoever. They have never had an annual, they've never had an audit of any type, unless they requested it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they received federal funds over a certain dollar threshold, then they would have audit requirements. But Iowa has literally hundreds of cities that are population of less than 700. So the legislature in 2013 established a new law. So now even our smallest of cities with populations such as 50, they do have a periodic examination requirement, meaning that either the state auditor's office or a private CPA firm will come in and do an examination of their financial transactions at least once every 8 years. And I know that sounds like a long period of time, but it's better than no audit requirements whatsoever. It is done spontaneously. They have roughly 2 weeks' notice before an auditor will be in there. And it was simply a decision that was based off of logic. There was approximately 600 cities in the state of Iowa that fell in this category. And we knew that in our office, we couldn't do 600 cities in a year. So we are partnering with private CPA firms to satisfy this requirement. And we knew that we could get to approximately 75 cities per year. That's what brought the 8 years for the General Assembly to make the decision a couple years ago.
So your odds are, I mean, you don't want to chance it if you're in there. You've got pretty good odds of being audited, right?
It will help. There's absolutely no doubt about that, because now cities know that somebody can and will be contacting them at some point, and they will be verifying the financial transactions, the receipts, and the disbursements. So,
you said two weeks' notice. Is fraud easy to see? Warning signs of fraud when you open a local government's books right away? Can you detect the footprints?
I'm going to answer that in two ways. In this particular case, if just looking at the bank statements alone and trying to reconcile them, this would have been noticed fairly easily, which is why I would like to bring up responsibility of other city officials, school officials, any official who is responsible for public funds. They have a responsibility when they are elected or appointed to serve in this capacity. They should be asking questions of their financial person. They should be asking for documentation regarding disbursements. They should be reconciling bank statements. They should be reconciling payments that residents have for various fees, making sure that people are paying on time, that certain folks aren't getting a discount because they happen to be related to, you know, certain other individuals. So things can be caught easily. though that is not the typical purpose of a regular financial statement audit. So I want to make sure that when you're examining somebody's books to see if there's any irregularities versus a regular financial statement audit, which is basically making sure that management's presentation of the financial statements are presented fairly. But it does help detour fraud to know that somebody, whether it's an outside auditor or whether it's your own city council members and mayor that are looking at your transactions each and every month. So if we had had people that were looking at the bank statements, looking at the supposed documentation behind the disbursements, that could have helped in this particular case.
Mary Mosman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Iowa Auditor of State, live in our Des Moines studio. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Finally, this half hour, under legislation being sought by the Iowa Department of Public Safety with the backing of our governor, Terry Branstad, it would be illegal to make handheld cell phone calls while driving. Also, texting while driving would become a primary offense instead of a secondary offense. Here to explain a little bit about this proposal to us and some of the science behind distracted driving, Dan McGeehee joins us again, director of the Transportation and Vehicle Safety Research Division at the University of Iowa's Public Policy Center. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Ben.
What are the proposed changes?
Well, right now we have a secondary offense law for texting specifically, which means that a police officer needs to see you not wearing your safety belt or speeding while they see you on the phone texting. Otherwise, they can't pull you over. So this new law proposes to make it a primary offense, which means that if an officer sees you texting, they can pull you over for that offense.
Okay. And what about handheld cell phone calls? That would be illegal. A lot of people do that.
Yes, that's one area that this was also would move into, and that is that the act of actually dialing the phone is one of the most dangerous part of the cell phones when you're handling, locating the phone and so forth. The actual talking part, if you have like a Bluetooth or a hands-free, would be okay. But it's really the elements of where you locate your phone, start
so it's using your hands. Voice activation gets you away from the distraction
once
with Bluetooth or whatever.
Once you're on the phone, I think one of the limitations of these kinds of so-called hands-free laws is that they sort of forget that the majority of the distraction is when you're handling the phone, when you're answering it. You have to locate it. It's in your pocket. It's in your purse and so forth. And that's what's sort of missing. But this is oftentimes, lawmakers can sort of get in between and just call it a hands-free law.
Okay. We can tell when anybody does this, and if they're honest with themselves, they can tell that they're distracted for whatever number of seconds while they're driving, be it texting or calling, getting that number, fishing that number out, fishing the cell phone out from a purse or from the seat next to you or a glove box or something like that. What do statistics tell us about how much more dangerous a driver is when he or she is engaged in such activities?
I think we need to step back and sort of look at the history of the mobile phone by itself. I mean, 10 years ago, we were using mobile phones that were sort of the flip phones, and we were largely talking. Now, it's almost impossible to find a basic flip phone. You can find them, but that's the exception. So now we replace that with the smartphone and look at all the different features. The Swiss Army knife of our lives is in our hands, in our pockets all the time. So we're not only doing email, we're doing Instagram, we're doing Snapchat, we're doing Facebook. There's so many different applications. We're looking at the weather while we drive. And, you know, driving, by and large, is a fairly boring activity. So we tend to fill in driving with the things that make us more entertained.
Mm-hmm. And that makes us, statistically speaking, how much more dangerous when we're texting, for example?
Yeah, so if you just take a look at the normal text message, and this is something that we've studied here at the University of Iowa for quite some time, generally takes about 4 seconds, your eyes about 4 seconds off the road while you drive to just take that first gulp away at your cell phone. And during that time, 4 seconds, and you're driving on the highway, you're driving about 90 feet per second. You know, that's like driving the entire length of Kinnick Stadium, including the grandstands, without looking at the road.
With your eyes closed.
With your eyes closed, exactly. In fact, some of the first studies in driver distraction looked at putting a hood over your face for several seconds and seeing how people would drive. So it's really a significant issue. When you start to look at how much we're doing it, that becomes the problem, is that historically—
Right. I wanted to touch on that. That's exactly where I was going, Dan McGeehee, is that with this such a ubiquitous activity, is there really How much hope do you have that laws can change behavior the drastic amount that seems to be necessary to increase safety?
I think laws are just one part of the issue. We are seeing in our own data and across the country that people are starting to self-regulate a little bit. And what that means is that they might choose to look at their phone when they're at a stop sign or at a stoplight versus choose to type out a text message while they're actually driving. So I think that's some of the good news is people are sort of trying to reconcile how to use this system, because we all have had close calls where we're looking off the road. It might even be a billboard. I mean, there are lots of things that distract us while we drive. Like I said, it's generally a fairly boring activity, and so we're looking for things that interest.
Mm-hmm. In terms of laws, we're coming up at the to the end of our segment here, but in terms of laws, how does Iowa compare with other states? Are we in the middle, progressive, or behind things?
We're lagging behind other states because of this primary versus secondary issue in particular. There are very few states that have secondary texting laws. Most will have primary laws.
So when we travel to another state, we have to be aware it's likely that state will, a police officer may pull us over just for texting without any other cause.
That's very, very possible, mm-hmm. especially in sort of the texting arena.
Here's a scenario that I know I'm not alone in experiencing, Dan. While driving, of course, other drivers, you have to interact with them, and you're inconvenienced by a driver who is driving in some way poorly. And then there's some inattention by that driver, whatever, I don't know. But you see it's caused by a cell phone. Is there anything you can do at that point besides simply being really annoyed that that person is giving a lot of attention to a cell phone rather than driving safely?
Well, it can be a slippery slope in trying to figure out if it's just around that. Sometimes people are actually drunk and on the cell phone at the same time. And certainly I've had the occasion to watch somebody that was clearly impaired and weaving around the road. And you can call 911 and report a person that's being a danger to themselves or others. So that's something that police hear about frequently.
Well, what about if this new law would be a primary? If you saw someone texting, could you get that license plate and report them, you think, Dan?
That's a really good question. I think we need to bring another person on board to answer that. But, sometimes, especially in the smaller communities, I know that police will sometimes just make a call to somebody and say, hey, by the way, somebody called and said they were concerned about your behavior.
It's sort of a nice reminder that
People are watching, yes.
People are watching, and this is indeed a danger to a lot of people. Very quickly, what's happening in your lab at the moment?
Wow, we have lots of things going on right now. We've just finished a very large study for the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety that's looked at 1,700 crashes that we've captured on video cameras from the inside out. Excuse me. And we're going to be releasing that report in the next few weeks that kind of shows what's happening inside a car before a serious crash.
I bet you we're going to want to have you back to talk about that and put some of that video on our website. Thank you,
yes,
Dan McGeehy,
great.
Director of the Transportation and Vehicle Safety Research Division at the University of Iowa's Public Policy Center. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. When we come back, we'll talk about how to fund legal services for low-income Iowans. Also, an Iowa police department that brings back baseball-like cards, cop cards they're called, and it's about more than just fun. We'll find out about that. And Alan Zarnetsky will be along, meteorologist at UNI, to talk about how this winter is stacking up against winters from the past. It's your NewsBuzz edition of River to River on this Friday. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a NewsBuzz edition on this Friday. Fridays, we like to wrap up the week by having quick conversations about some news items that we didn't get to otherwise during our week of talk shows. Coming up in a few minutes, cop cards return to Iowa City. Yes, just like baseball cards, only they feature police officers. And they're quite a hit in Iowa City, as they have been in other towns in Iowa. Also, a stock taking of this winter weather compared to past years with meteorologist Alan Zarnetsky. But now, following up on a story we covered here on River to River several months ago, in July, We talked about how Iowa Legal Aid, this is an organization that provides legal services for low-income Iowans, was campaigning for a proposal to require most Iowa attorneys to pay a yearly $100 fee to support this nonprofit's budget. Now, the Iowa Supreme Court has just declined to enforce such a fee. Joining me to talk about it now, Dennis Gronenboom, Executive Director of Iowa Legal Aid. Iowa Legal Aid, the state's largest organization offering civil legal services to poor residents. Dennis Gronenboom, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
What was your reaction when you heard the ruling of Iowa's High Court?
Well, we were disappointed that the court decided not to take the step at this time. On the other hand, in some ways gratified that the court recognizes there's a problem. They indicated the commitment to address it and to try to address it in a comprehensive way. So both disappointment but also some optimism that the issue that's been raised will be addressed in some other manner.
So make the case. Why did you feel this $100 fee was needed when you've been operating without it up to now?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, one of the primary funding sources for Iowa Legal Aid and many legal aid programs around the country is a commission called the Interest on Lawyer Trust Account Commission. There's one exists in Iowa and in other states. The funds that come into the Interest on Lawyer Trust Account Commission are funds that are on deposit from clients in lawyers' offices. So the interest rates, that we all know, has gone down substantially. So the amount of funds that are available through that grant program are down about 80%, which for us is a reduction of over $800,000 nearly $800,000 in grants. Couple that with the fact that Iowa's population, low-income population, continues to increase. The 2000 census reported that approximately 360,000 Iowans lived at 125% of poverty or below, which is our eligibility level. And more recent census data indicates that that's about 500,000 people. So one in six Iowans are eligible for services from Iowa Legal Aid who have civil legal problems. So the combination of the fact that that revenue source was down and the need continues to go up, our board of directors looked at what are some possible options to replenish those funds. And this is a type of a program that exists in several other states, including four that touch Iowa: Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Missouri all have this type of a program and an assessment. So that's why we went down this road and suggested it to the court.
Mm-hmm. This affects a lot of cases. I understand Iowa Legal Aid closed on an average of 23,000 cases per year between 2008 and 2012. So this is not an insignificant number of cases.
It is not, and our most recent data indicates that we are down about 32% in the cases that we closed from 2010 to what we closed in 2014. We closed a little over 18,000 cases. Now, that's not because there's reduced need. As I indicated, the number of people who are eligible for services has gone up. Our staffing has gone down. We're down about 18 lawyers from what we were in 2010, which obviously translates to fewer cases that can be handled. So the funds that would have been raised through this type of a fee would have impacted, by even conservative estimates, we would have been able to close an additional 2,000 cases a year, impacting in the neighborhood of 5,000-plus Iowans who live in those households.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the implications of this ruling in just a moment. But you made the case for this fee, but what were the arguments that in the end swayed the Supreme Court in Iowa that won the day?
Well, I think the court was not willing at this point, and I want to emphasize at this point, I don't think that the discussion about this is over with, willing to apply this type of an assessment to lawyers in Iowa. The arguments that were against it is that people felt that it was a societal problem and should be addressed through general revenues. I agree that access to the court system is a societal problem, but I think that having lawyers take the lead, because lawyers have an ethical obligation to provide legal services to low-income people on a pro bono basis and also to provide financial support to organizations that provide services to low-income people. So I think that the approach would have been a good first step to say lawyers are taking the lead to address this issue, and now the rest of us need to come along and address it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still optimistic, Ben, that we're going to end up with a more comprehensive solution.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I understand in reading about this, it really split Iowa attorneys. Some saw it as you said, an ethical obligation to have this fee in addition to pro bono work, but others saw it as an unnecessary tax. I wonder, what are the implications you see of this ruling past your organization's resources and ability to handle the number of cases that are out there that don't have the money to support them among low-income Iowans?
Well, I think that we need to look at the types of issues that low-income Iowans confront. And, you know, we have a great justice system in this country, but different segments of society need access to that court system for different reasons. Low-income people often rely on access to the justice system for issues related to their safety, their shelter, their income. And so, you know, what this means is that there will be that many fewer Iowans who will be able to get protection from domestic violence, who are going to avoid eviction or foreclosure of their homes, who are going to be subjected to consumer scams and loss of income and government support programs. So I think that the focus of this really needs to be on what this does to low-income Iowans and translating that into what it does to the court system and to the communities that these clients live in, or these low-income Iowans live in. For instance, in the when people go into the court system without the representation of a lawyer proceeding pro se, it slows down the system. It's more difficult for judges and opposing counsel to deal with it. Having people have representation gets to a more efficient result and a more fair result.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned before, the Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Cady wrote in the order that does not require Iowa attorneys to pay this yearly $100 fee to support low-income legal services. But he also said the state needs to find more ways to provide representation to its poorest residents. So what are the other solutions? The legislature, where are you looking now for your most hopeful prospects?
Well, I think, as you indicated, the court clearly said in the opinion that this is a problem that does need to be addressed. And I think there are a variety of ways that we can address that. There is state funding that's provided. There's been tremendous support from the Iowa legislature and from Governor Branstad and Attorney General Miller, whose budget our state funding is included. There are certainly conversations out there and requests for increases in state funding. There's an organization called the Iowa Legal Aid Foundation that raises funds from private donations and businesses, and those are certainly a part of the solution. But I think there needs to be, the broader conversation that the court really has suggested here. And I think that, the possibility of lawyers contributing in additional ways, including taking more pro bono cases and providing more financial support, whether it's through this type of an assessment or a voluntary payment, will be things that need to be on the table for discussion.
Okay, thank you very much. Executive Director of Iowa Legal Aid, Dennis Gronenboom. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa City Police Department has brought back cop cards back to the streets. Last month, after a pause of 7 years, the police in Iowa City started handing out the cards, and they look and feel just like baseball cards. Except, you guessed it, they feature a photo of a police officer, along with some personal information about that officer on the back. Joining me now to talk about it, Iowa City Police Department's Crime Prevention Officer, R.A. Mebus. Officer Mebus, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're a 24-year veteran of the Iowa City Police Department. These cards are more than just fun. They are certainly fun, but more than just that. Talk about that.
The idea behind the cop card program is very simply a little bit of fun with the community. The atmosphere across the country has been so dark and negative for the last few months. We were looking for a way to allow people to approach an officer in a non-threatening, friendly way, have an officer reach out to somebody with just something fun. So we decided to bring back cop cards.
Mm-hmm. So this is an excuse. Has this always been kind of a barrier that you try to overcome, that when you're sitting in your squad car or walking on the street, that you want people to feel like you're approachable?
Absolutely. So many times people look at the police department as somebody that's off in the distance, in the shadows, always there but not there. And the reality of it is, we're your neighbors. Hmm. We're part of this community also. We're no different than anybody else in the community, save a specific job description. But the idea is, it's just us. We're members of the community, and we'd like to interact with other people in our town and very simply have a conversation.
So this has been in effect for a few weeks. How's it been going now that you've put this back into action?
It's going famously from my point of view. I spend a lot of my time out in the public view and interacting with various ages, and it's catching on very quickly. I personally have already handed out over 500 cop cards.
Mm. So describe your card to me.
My card has a special visitor from our crime prevention past. McGruff the Crime Dog makes an appearance, which is exciting for me because I always like McGruff when he steps up and says, you know, take a bite out of crime. Mm-hmm. And it's a talking point for a lot of our younger members that may not remember those commercials. But the older members of our community, and that can be, I've had people that were 80-some years young want cop cards.
Mm-hmm. Do you have the McGruff voice down?
I don't have the voice down myself, even though I try, because I don't quite have that intensity and that low-level growl that McGruff can put into it when he's taking a bite out of crime.
Well, you can give it a try on air here.
Yeah, because it's just kind of a, you know, I can get down here and take a bite out of crime. But McGruff has that undertone that only McGruff the Crime Dog can have. It's quite unique. It's quite special. And when the kids realize what's going on, they do have a good giggle about it.
Tell me about some of the other cards that are kind of off the wall, perhaps.
The interesting part of this particular set is there's nothing standardized. We've done things in the past where every officer has a very similar card. It's just about different people. But this time I asked the volunteers to show me a little bit about your personality. Something that's fun for you. We have an Ironman athlete in our midst.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, perhaps you might see an Ironman athlete shoulder pressing a squad car. Truly, I was amazed. We've incorporated backdrops from around our beautiful city, whether it be the Old Capitol Mall. We have sports fans, so naturally Kinnick Stadium comes into play a little bit. But there's a couple in there that I don't want to share all the secrets, because if you look close at all the cards, you're going to see one officer more than once.
Hmm.
But you have to look very close and find Waldo.
Okay.
And we'll release some of those fun facts probably later this summer as we more and more of the edition is released.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you might even find a cop with a donut or two. I don't know why that's funny. I don't understand that at all.
You've got to watch more TV, officer.
Absolutely, because in reality, with some of the businesses in our town, who doesn't like a good donut now and again?
Exactly. On the more serious side, I can imagine some people thinking this is a good idea. Make a police officer more approachable. Do something fun. Especially with the tension that's been across the nation concerning police officers this year. But perhaps also thoughts, worries that this might be a distraction, that you might or another officer might miss something because you're having fun handing out cop cards.
I don't think we can miss a lot of the important things in our town when we learn about the people in our town. I think that's very important, and I you're right. On any given minute of any given day, it may not be the most important thing that's going on, but in the long term, for the health and well-being of our community, I find activities like this vital.
Mm-hmm.
People need to know who we are and that we are part of the community and that they can trust us. We do the job of protect and serve. But we can do it with a smile, a handshake, trade a cop card or two, and still get the job done in our town. Reality be known, we don't have a lot of the trouble that huge metro areas have. This is still a wonderful community of advocacy, looking out for each other and taking care of each other. And this is just one small part. If we can bring a smile to your day and let somebody shake the hand of a police officer that may have been scared to approach before, it's absolutely worth it to us.
Mm-hmm. How unique is this in Iowa, do you know?
It's the idea itself is not unique by any means. It's been going on for 15, 20 years. I haven't heard anybody else in Iowa that's doing the program right now. Other agencies, even within 100 miles of Iowa City, have done it in the past, but I don't know of anybody that's doing it today.
Officer Mebus, have you felt the tensions that have been in the nation down at the level of the Iowa City Police Department?
There has been tension felt in our town by both police officers and our community members. We all watch for each other and watch what's going on across our country. I've stated before, there are many good things in our community that are ongoing. We want to keep tabs on the negative things so that we don't experience what they're experiencing across the country. All of us have worked very hard for a lot of years to make sure that we're partners with our community and work together to resolve issues before they become huge and uncontrollable.
Okay. Officer R.A. Mebus is Iowa City's department's crime prevention officer, 24-year veteran of the department. If you find him out on patrol, you can ask for his cop card, which will feature him and, as he says, McGruff, take a bite out of crime. Thank you, officer.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me here.
And finally on this News Buzz Friday, a prediction came this week that concerns us all as we continue to slip into our snow boots and into our parkas. It came around 7:25 this past Monday morning in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. That's right. You've guessed it. Punxsutawney Phil, the world's most beloved and furry seasonal prognosticator, gave his prediction about how much winter still lies before us.
Yes, a shadow I see. You can start the Twitter. Hashtag six more weeks of winter.
Oh, Punxsutawney Phil did see his shadow. Sorry to break that news to you. Perhaps you heard it earlier this week. He's not so quite as cute and furry as Punxsutawney Phil, but we think Alan Czarnecki delivers much better weather information to us anyway. Professor of Meteorology at the University of Northern Iowa. Alan, welcome back to the program.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
So what is standing out about this winter to you so far?
Oh, you know, I suppose the contrast to what we had last year. Last year in Iowa, we had our ninth coldest winter in our record books. And just in contrast to that, you know, we started out with kind of a harsh November that seemed to set us up for another repeat performance of last winter. But then December was warmer than normal, and January turned out to be that way as well. So looks like just the contrast in the temperatures, I suppose, is probably the biggest thing for most of us.
Right. What was behind that mild January, that number of days there when we thought, wow, this feels almost like spring?
Right. Well, the first half of January actually was pretty cold, and the second half got milder. Yeah. You know, and it's actually not unusual in January to have a January thaw, as it's referred to. There is some evidence that that's an actual breakdown of a large weather system in the atmosphere, in the upper part of the atmosphere that we've sort of observed over a long period of time. So to get at least a little break in the cold temperatures is not that unusual. But when it lasts for a couple of weeks, then we kind of take special note of that. It just the cold polar air just got bottled up a little bit farther to the north of us, and some of that decided to sag back down over us this past week, and looks like it's going to kind of make its way out of here again over the next few days.
So we're warming up over the weekend. Given what we have now, what do you see in the weeks to come on into March if you want to go that far?
Well, you know, what I see for about the next week or so, it looks like we should be mild through the weekend, early next week. Looks like by the middle of next week, we get closer to normal again. And the projections that go out that far project pretty much near normal temperatures through about the middle of February or so. And unfortunately, the Climate Prediction Center's projections for the months ahead of us do not give us any clear indication of what the temperatures or the precip might do for that matter. It looks like there's essentially what they call equal chances that we could be above normal, below normal, or even near normal. So it's not a very useful forecast, but it's really the best way to convey the state of the science.
Right. When you say that, well, the ground is not frozen as it was last year, does that influence the weather, the ground, the lakes, the rivers are not frozen to the degree they were last year, certainly?
It does, but we also have very extensive snow cover over the upper Midwest, and so that chills. It keeps the cold air that does surge down from the north rather cold, and so it does arrive still in a pretty cold state. And so even with the warm surge that we're going to have this weekend, it's got a lot of snow cover underneath it that's going to chill it down more than what we might like it to.
Alan Czarnecki, professor of meteorology at the University of Northern Iowa, thanks for joining us on the tail end of this edition of River to River.
Thanks, Ben.
And coming up Monday on this program, we'll talk about how the Iowa Board of Regents is trying to change how Iowa state universities are funded. We'll talk with lawmakers, also with the president of the Board of the Regents. So I'll talk with Bruce Rastetter and talk through that plan with lawmakers. That's tomorrow, rather Monday at this time. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Catherine Perkins, our executive producer. We always enjoy your comments, your questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.